DW Africa Link.
South Africa, the host of this year's G20 summit, is making history by welcoming the world's largest economies to its soil. This is a big deal and a source of pride for the African continent. It's a great chance for African civil society to make African-centered demands and showcase the continent's potential on a global stage. The possibilities are endless, and the potential for positive change is immense. So what can we really expect from the summit, and how will it benefit the African continent? That's what's coming up. I am Eddie Micah Jr., and you are welcome to Africa Link, the podcast connecting you to the stories that matter.
Africa Link, every weekday here on DW.
The G20 summit in South Africa has become a battleground for activists, especially those from Africa and the global south. They are fighting to get their voices heard, and the summit is their platform. Their goal is a people-first agenda. They are demanding action on climate justice, debt relief, and equality. Basically, they want to stop the closed-door elite negotiations and start creating real solutions that actually help ordinary people. South Africa's G20 presidency expanded the official social summit as a flagship platform for diverse group discussions to help solve real-world problems. So let's dive into this with Sekwedlane Pamodi, Director, New Economy Hub, African Climate Foundation, an activist, strategist, and advocate for just transitions and climate-resilient economies. I also have Diane Hawker with me, DW correspondent in South Africa. Welcome, both of you, to Africa Link. Diane, this is the first G20 summit ever held on African soil. How does it feel to have the world's most powerful economies in your country, South Africa?
Well, Eddie, I would say it's a slightly familiar feeling. For the South Africans who remember the 2010 World Cup, there was an air of a little bit of an excitement, a little bit of nervousness for hosting such a big event, a lot of buzz around. And I feel like there is maybe not to that same extent because the G20 is happening in Johannesburg, but certainly in this part of the country, there is an air of excitement. Around the city, there's been a lot of cleaning up that's happening. Beautification is what the government calls it. So they've been fixing some of the roads leading to the Nasrec venue where the G20 will be held. And of course, in true South African style, lots of people making jokes saying that the tidying up is only happening because we have visitors coming. But what happens after the visitors leave? That being said, I would say that it has been an opportunity to have a lot of different discussions, which has been quite interesting. Outside of the main G20 events, there are also a lot of other events that have been taking place. And the good thing is that some of the smaller events have been taking place in other parts of the country. So the finance ministers went to meet in Durban or in KZN, for example. There were also some smaller events in the province of Limpopo. So some other parts of the country are also getting a little bit of that G20 razzle-dazzle.
Right. Is it just me or Dan? You were just bragging. South Africa is hosting it, so okay. Okay, I get that. And you're very welcome to keep bragging. But to the crunch of, you know, the essence of all this G20 summit, you are our person on the ground and you covering it. Give us the overall mood at the summit and tell us what's going on.
I wouldn't say that I'm bragging, but I do think it's quite an important event to have on the African continent, particularly because a lot of the issues that are being discussed at the main G20 event do directly affect a lot of people in Africa and the global south. You know, we have a lot of these big events, and sometimes the question is, why should we care? But a lot of the time, these people are the people who are making decisions that affect millions of lives. If you look at some of the countries that are within the G20, they represent a significant portion of the global population. So it is important that they are discussing issues that are actually relevant to the majority of the population and also relevant to Africans. I think from a South African perspective, there has been an effort to really Africanize the G20 agenda this year. Mm. The key issues that they've looked at include issues relating to debt, global debt, which is something that a lot of African countries are worried about, that directly affects their ability to provide services to their population. And the issue of inequality has also been a big topic amongst the G20 members. How do they tackle it? There is a report that was commissioned by South Africa that's under discussion. And the South African government is, of course, hoping that there will be some resolutions that speak to solutions, because it's one thing to have a big talk shop, but if there aren't solutions that come from it, then, you know, what really is the point? So I think with that kind of focus on issues that really relate to Africans and African countries, if they are able to really get those resolutions passed or taken through further, it could be something that's quite beneficial for us here on the African continent.
Right. Well said. I still think you were bragging a bit, but it's all good. You have the right to do that. Let me come to you, Sekwetlana. You're focusing a lot on this summit. I'd want you to highlight the importance of a G20 summit to governance overall on the continent.
Sure. Thanks, Eddie. So let's maybe start with understanding why the G20 exists and what it's supposed to do in order to be able to respond to your prompt. So the G20 emerges out of the global financial crisis that happened around 2009. And for us, 1Ks, as the young people are calling us, we might remember that prior to the global financial crisis was a solvency crisis, and prior to that solvency crisis was already the emergence of a fiscal crisis all over the world, which was driven largely by the banking industry and how unregulated they were. As we know, the whole global financial system really depends on debt to drive the economy. All of these lending instruments that are then, you know, that amalgamate debtors, which are then traded between creditors. And in the main, those debtors tend to be sovereigns, nation states. When they experience a solvency crisis, we then start to see the bond markets, the private capital markets, which are driven by the banks and asset managers, then start to get very nervous because their investors want to pull out their money as quickly as possible. But that money can't get out because there's a serious solvency crisis and also a fiscal crisis. Not enough money to pay for the stuff that governments need to pay for, and not enough money to pay back the creditors. Now, we find ourselves in a very similar, an eerily similar position today. As Diane was saying, we are in a situation in Africa particularly, but also in developing economies across the world. This is the majority world, what we used to call the global south. We're seeing that they are also starting to experience a real solvency crisis, particularly in Africa. Just to give you an example, 25 African countries are spending more in servicing debt than they are investing in public education, which is fundamental for building the knowledge capital that is required, the skills base that is required in order to grow their economies and drive this inclusive, people-centered growth. Another example, 35 countries in Africa are spending more in servicing debt costs than they are in spending on public healthcare. So civil servants, nurses, doctors, teachers are unable to serve the peoples of our countries because debt, which is priced in very predatory ways through the collusion of the large sovereigns, the multilateral development banks, and most significantly, private equity and asset managers working in concert with the credit ratings agency.
And so from all that you've said, I know many Africans will be listening now and wonder, because, you know, when you talk about the G20, that's a very powerful block. Just to put things into perspective, this represents about, what, 85% of global GDP, 75% of international trade, you know, just about 2/3 of the world's population in there. Then many Africans are wondering, it's been there for a while, we don't seem to benefit anything from it. So why is the G20 important for Africa?
Because we work in a deeply globally connected world, and our economy is also so deeply integrated. You may recall the globalization that was driven really hard from around the 70s, coincidentally, more or less along the same time as the colonies or the former colonies were freeing themselves from the colonial powers post-war, because it became financially no longer viable for the colonial powers to continue holding these colonies. We find ourselves in a system, a world system, where the former imperial powers are still in real control of how the architecture of the global economy functions. And so we need to have a system or a mechanism by which we are able to negotiate our ways out of the situation of high debt, deprivation, and economic stagnation that at least we as African countries find ourselves in, because we simply can't do it by ourselves. We don't have the power to supply these outcomes to ourselves.
How is that going for Africa so far? Has Africa benefited in any way from the G20 that has been going on for many years now?
In some ways, yes, and in other way, and in many ways, no. So, what are the ways in which the that African countries have benefited from the G20? Well, first and foremost, South Africa was one of the first African countries to be given a seat at the G20 table as one of the significant economies of the world, and there has been an enormous amount of advocacy done by the South African government to really push for what is now emerging as the newest and largest consumer market, if you will, in Africa, or the African Union, in having a seat at the G20. This is the first year that the AU is there. What this means is that then we are shifting the balance of forces to have our interests represented there. Now, as you said, these things take many, many years. It's been 20 years until the African Union could represent the newest and largest consumer market on this platform. So it's going to probably take another 20 years to really address some of the more fundamental issues that actually will get African development growing and being driven in an inclusive manner rather than in the extractive manner than it has been operating on for the last 20 or so years.
Why should it take that much time? Means we're going to be talking about this every year until the next 15 to 20 years before we see change. Is that normal?
Well, I mean, it's down to the way in which the G20 operates. The G20 operates on a full consensus basis in order to be able to issue out signals to the rest of the architecture of the world economy and of the multilateral system to be able to know what it is that the largest economies of the world agree or don't agree to as far as driving inclusive growth and development that is sustainable for our planet. So let me just give you a practical example. We find ourselves in a situation where we need to very rapidly and very urgently deploy renewable energy technologies across the world because we are in a serious climate crisis. The way that the economy runs depends on fossil fuels because it depends on energy. Now, in order for our countries to be able to act as urgently as they need to with the speed that they need to, there has to be an agreement between the large world economies that, one, there is a climate emergency in play, two, that it has to do with fossil fuels, three, that the only way to get our way out of this is to deploy renewable energy as quickly as possible, and four, perhaps the most important thing, that the rich countries of the world, which enriched themselves not only through colonial plunder, but also through fossil fuel exploitation to power their economies, which poorer economies like African economies have not been able to, now need to pay climate reparations to the poorer countries of the world through public finance. However, if the European countries of the world, if the North American countries of the world, Australia and Japan don't agree at the G20 level that more public finance is required and want to foist more debt on us, then we are not going to be able to deploy the renewable energy technology that we need. And then we find ourselves in a situation where we are going to start exploiting our fossil fuel resources to the detriment of our planet and the planetary habitability in the medium to long term in the midst of a climate crisis. So, you know, the consensus basis by which the G20 operates is really a critical issue that can either move things forward, but often usually impedes our ability to drive the inclusive growth and development that African and developing economies require with urgency.
Right. Let me come back to you, Diane. We know the theme for this year's G20 summit: solidarity, equality, sustainability. You know, South Africa holding the presidency places social justice, inclusive growth, and multilateral equity at the heart of global governance. What are some of the strong demands coming from participants at the summit so far, Diane?
We know that the United States has been very vocal about not attending this year's G20 conference. And as a major global player, the fact that the US is not there is causing quite a lot of concern about whether they'll actually be able to come up with a resolution at the end of this conference. There are also other countries that have chosen to not send their heads of state, but to send other representatives, which in itself is not a crisis, but it also depends on how much negotiating power and ability to sign or to agree these kind of proxies have, as opposed to the global leaders. So that is one thing that the South African government has been grappling with in trying to get their agenda points kind of confirmed or to move forward with some kind of a consensus. South Africa is looking to get some kind of a solution.
The elephant in the room, the US, is not there. Challenging for South Africa, obviously. What difference does that make in terms of the demands coming out from participants at the summit?
Well, it could make a significant difference if other countries also choose to kind of side with the US. So because the G20 works on this consensus basis, and if other countries who are present feel that the US needs to be part of the discussion and then choose not to agree with South Africa's points, it would mean that instead of having a conference resolution, which other countries agree to and have buy-in on, that then there would only be a chairperson's resolution, which is a kind of a weaker document, and it's not really something that can be taken forward. The G20 presidency is only for 1 year at a time, so you really need that buy-in from the other members to be able to take your issues that were discussed in 1 year forward onto the following year. And South Africa is meant to hand over to the United States next year. So it is a major sticking point at this point as to how they move forward.
Right. I mean, it's a very valid point you raise, because we are talking about, because the US somehow is not heavily involved in this year's summit, that whatever comes out of this summit may be difficult to carry out. I mean, Sikwedlana, how does that make you feel that, you know, one country more or less can help decide how powerful or not, or how strong or not this particular summit goes?
Yeah, that's a good question, Eddie. You know, we need to remember that the USA has not been actively participating in the G20 this year under South Africa's presidency. And there was a lot of concern, and we should all be concerned, that the US was effectively blocking The G20's ability to build consensus. Remember that multilateralism works on a system of dialogue, negotiation, and agreement. And when the system is incapable of doing that, because any one or more parties are not willing to come to the table, then we have a real problem on our hands. Even so, there is still a window of opportunity here. Work can still happen. And what I think could happen if the remaining members of the G20 were courageous enough is to start demonstrating, even through a chair summary, essentially a coalition of the willing, you know, to demonstrate that there is a shift in the geopolitical balance of power across the world, that it is imperfect because we can't get perfect outcomes out of negotiations. Everyone has to lose something, but that there is at least a broad agreement or consensus amongst most or all but one country of the world around the major priorities, around the extent and urgency of the climate emergency, the extent and the emergency of the debt crisis, which is right now in Africa, but spreading through much of Europe and the rest of the world as well. And that there are real measures like dropping the debt, providing clear debt relief measures through transformation of the G20 common framework and debt treatments, as well as on agreeing and demonstrating will behind the taxation of the super rich that is then operationalized through the UN convention framework on international tax cooperation. These are fundamental things that the members of the G20 right now can agree on, can form a consensus on with or without any one particular superpower in the room, to demonstrate that the world will continue to spin even if one country or one superpower doesn't come to the party.
Right. Look, let's all be optimistic then. We know that talk is cheap, and it's not automatic that whatever is agreed on at the G20 summit is actually practically what will be done on the ground. But I'm going to be like you, Sekwutlana, and be optimistic. Because from NGOs to community leaders, the summit is putting people at the center of global governance. So could this be the turning point for inclusive decision making, and not just deciding, but actually getting it done, Sekwutlana?
I don't know whether the G20 is the place for inclusive decision making. If you want inclusive decision making, you've got to get the people on board. And this is why, on the margins of the G20 Leaders Summit, we are also running a We the 99% People Summit for Global Economic Justice, where we're bringing over, it's over 3,000 participants from over 35 countries of the majority world with our Global North allies and partners, to actually work out a political program of action about how it is that we are going to engage as well as agitate for our national governments to do what is required and scale up the advocacy and engagement work that needs to happen. Global cooperation requires the assent of the people, and the people need to be embedded in the decisions that national governments are making. And if we can find a way or if we can build a platform for action that is locally embedded but globally connected, then we can probably have this more inclusive global governance system that we all aspire for.
Okay, well said. Now, I know I said you have the final words, but I started on a personal note with Diane, and I'm going to wrap up personally with Diane. Diane, at the end of the day, any plans for after summits, like chill out or something?
Well, you know, for the journalists that have been covering this summit, the last few weeks, I would say, have been quite intense. So my post G20 plan is really just to sleep for a few days. There's been quite a lot going on, many events, many side events, many briefings to attend. And so once all the planes take off, I will be taking my shoes off and getting directly into bed.
Well said. I don't know if I can argue with that, but thank you very much, both of you, for your submissions. Sekwutlana Pamodi, Director, New Economy Hub, African Climate Foundation, and also Diane Hawker, DW correspondent in South Africa. Thanks to you both.
Thanks.
African civil society demands that public resources be redirected from debt service to human needs. Experts warn that social progress hinges on freeing up funding for health, education, and green development. But will these voices truly influence the world's most powerful economies? Some thoughts from South Africa.
Certainly. I mean, I think firstly, the work of the G20 formal engagement groups, maybe let me start with that. The G20 engagement groups, which represent various sectors, including, for instance, civil society, business, are recognized or formal groupings that are able to feed in directly into the process of the G20. And those recommendations are up for consideration by the leaders and hopefully are able to find expression also in the leaders' declaration this weekend.
The 2025 G20 summit tests whether grassroots mobilization can move from the sidelines to the center of global policy, with South Africa's leadership framing solidarity, equality, and sustainability as shared responsibilities. A point is being made for people-powered policy at the world's most powerful economic table. What do you think? Share your thoughts on Facebook at DW Africa. Listen to us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And subscribe to our DW Africa YouTube channel so you never miss an episode. This show was co-produced and edited by Isaac Mugabe. And I am Eddie Micah Jr. Thanks for listening.
DW. Made for Minds.